Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on Liberty Radio Network and at scotthorton.org. Next up is our friend Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. That's independent.co.uk and author of the book Muqtada, who is going to be a part of this conversation, guarantee that. Welcome back to the show, Patrick. How are you?
Pretty good, Scott. Pretty good.
Good, good. Happy to know you're safe and sound over there in the war zone, or soon to be again. First of all, let's talk about, I believe your latest piece here is about Maliki and the prospect of government of unity, national salvation, something or another. I think he's agreed to one, but refused the other. Is there a difference? What's happening with that?
I think it's kind of irrelevant in a way, or at least it's not as big a deal as people say. You know, but one thing that's very obvious when you're in Baghdad, this country's already split apart. You know, you have the Kurdish north, and which has just expanded, taken Kirkuk and other places. That's defended by the Peshmerga, the Kurdish soldiers. Then you have the Sunni part, which is run by ISIS, so these mad fanatics who want to kill all Shia and Christians, which is about 60% of Iraqis, and then you have the Shia in Baghdad. And these country places are virtually at war with each other. So to talk about unity and a unity government, you know, it doesn't mean much, Scott. It might have meant something 5 years ago, 10 years ago, but it's kind of irrelevant now.
Yeah, I mean, well, when they say what they're talking about mostly, I don't know, they tend to leave the Kurds out of most of these arguments, I guess, because they figure the Kurds are all right, so we'll worry about them later or something. But they seem mostly to focus on, well, we'll bring some Sunnis into the government. But this was the benchmark of 2007 that never was met, this unity government.
There were Sunni in the government, but, you know, the Sunni sort of politicians got a share in the government, and they, you know, they got a share in the plunder. I don't think they passed much of it on to their own people. But, you know, at the moment, we just had, for instance, the British Foreign Secretary William Hague here today. We had John Kerry before. They keep going on and saying we need an inclusive government. But, you know, that's something which doesn't mean much when, you know, the Sunni part of the country is run by people who are planning to kill every Shia. They're not planning to negotiate with them. And they've done a lot of that already. So who are you going to include in this government? You know, a lot of basically washed out Sunni politicians who have no very little support within their own community. The leaders in Mosul had to run for their lives. They're in Kurdistan. The rest of them don't dare go back. So these guys are going to be given part of an inclusive government, and supposedly the 5 million Sunni community is going to say, oh, that's great. Well, you know, government can come back in. This isn't realistic, and it isn't going to happen. So they're kind of doing the things now that might have worked 5 or 6 years ago, but are now kind of ancient history.
Yeah, I just read a piece, I think it was the AP, about the guys in Washington, D.C. saying, well, it's going to be a little more difficult this time, but we're going to have to start back up the awakening movement and get the local Sunnis to turn on Al-Qaeda again.
Yeah, it's pathetic, really. You know, the surge was a bit exaggerated at the time. You know, the Sunni had decided they couldn't really fight the Shia and fight the Americans at the same time, so they did a deal with the Americans. They never stopped killing Shia, by the way. They're just kind of the mark of success was, God, look how few American soldiers are getting killed now. It's going right down. But there was much less attention to the fact an awful lot of Shia were still getting killed. So now the idea is that's going to happen, that somehow the tribal leaders, the other Sunni leaders, are going to use the Islamic State, which is always called Daesh here, I don't know the acronym of it, in Arabic, that they're going to use these people as sort of shock troops to take over their area and then get rid of them afterwards. But, you know, you're dealing with guys who are kind of Islamic Khmer Rouge, you know, and they can see this punch coming. And, you know, they're not going to roll over easily. And what one does know that these are some of the most ferocious people on the planet. So I think it's a bit naive to see things written here and there, saying it's just going to be like the great victories of 2007 and Islamic State and its fighters are just going to disappear.
Okay, now, it seems like, well, and I'm sorry to just, you know, ask you about the future, but it seems like the ISIS guys in Syria have been more focused on, you know, locking down Raqqa and the parts in the countryside in the east of the country where they already have control, rather than, you know, bashing their skulls up against the Assad regime, at least, you know, lately. So I wonder whether you think they're at this point going to try to conserve their gains, or whether they want to really try to retake Baghdad and die trying.
Well, that's a million-dollar question here. And, you know, I'm sitting in Baghdad, and they haven't tried yet. They might. I would have thought that chances go down a little as time goes on. You know, one thing, Scott, is that maybe their tremendous successes over the last 2 weeks, it only has been a couple of weeks since they took Mosul, they took the north of the country, last weekend they took the whole west of the country, that they're too spread out, that they're having difficulty in sort of refocusing their forces and deciding what they're going to do next. After all, there aren't that many of them. On the other hand, they certainly have cells in Baghdad. They could activate those. There are big Sunni enclaves in Baghdad. They could probably take those over if they wanted. They haven't done it yet. It's probably cards they don't quite want to play at the moment. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of what we're waiting for, is the moment that they either decide to go for Baghdad, or they decide to disrupt Baghdad, or maybe they're just going to wait. You know, we'll probably know soon enough.
Yeah, well, and I guess it just depends whether they think it's in their interest, one, to try to take the city, or two, to provoke, you know, pushback from the Shia, who basically they've just held their ground, right? Like the Mahdi army is still sitting there, Sadr's group. They're waiting by
time?
Yeah,
I mean, Muqtada said, you know, they could be used to defend the shrines, which I guess means also the sort of Shia areas, but they couldn't be an offensive force. And he's obviously frightened they'll turn into a sort of murder gang once again. Mm. So we got these militia here, and you see them in the streets. The Sunni in Baghdad are pretty frightened. Everybody's pretty frightened, actually, but nobody, you know, is really sure what's going to happen next. The idea that there can be an inclusive government, you know, and is going to offer the Sunnis something, you know, the idea would be essentially offering them power sharing. But hold on a minute, the guys that you're offering to share power with have already taken power right. In a quarter of the country. They're the only power in those Sunni areas now. Right. The government has fled. The Sunni have taken over. So why do they want to share power in Baghdad? Well, there are reasons. The oil revenues that come from the oil comes from the south. But for the moment, I don't think there's really any chance of having an inclusive government.
All right. Well, now, so what about the Jordanian border? I saw that they've taken at least one checkpoint there, and I wonder how long you think that border has to exist as an actual border anymore.
Well, it's right out there in the desert. You know, it's sort of, I've spent a lot of time in that border post. It's been taken over, and the guys who were running it are still running it, but it's sort of been taken over by ISIS. There aren't many trucks going through there. This used to be a sort of place that was sort of bustling night and day with trucks going past. Oh, but by the way, you know, just to gives an idea of how this country is broken up. Here I am in Baghdad, and the capital of Kurdistan is Erbil, which is about 200 miles to the north. Now, after a few weeks ago, you wanted to send a big truck, big vehicle carrying goods from Erbil to Baghdad. It cost you about $500. Current rate, I was talking to a guy who runs a company there, said $10,000 to do those 200 miles. So it tells you what the kind of perception of danger is here. And, the chances that people think that is in a, even a truck getting through.
Well, all right. So is there any kind of solution to this? If you were to, if one were to advise Maliki, should he just let the West go? And then that way there's no fight.
Well, he's not in a position to do anything else at the moment. He needs to defend Baghdad. This guy has just presided over one of the biggest military disasters in history and political disasters. So conceivably, he's not the man to lead Iraq forward. I mean, Kerry and the others say, we're not trying to press him to go. But of course, they say that so often. The message comes across, get out.
Right.
But I'm not sure how much good it's going to do them. We talked about this before.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Sunni are sort of facing a disaster, actually. I think, they had reasons for revolt. But by sort of handing over the leadership of this revolt to ISIS, by using these sort of mad fanatics as their shock troops, they've ensured that they sort of an enormous reaction from the Shia. Their areas are going to be isolated. What's going to happen to the Sunni in Baghdad? Long term, this is bad news for them. It isolates them a lot. What should be done about ISIS in general? Well, I think, this is, to a degree, this is the outcome of the very toxic and disastrous Western U.S. and European policy in Syria, that they fostered a Syrian opposition to Assad, which they claimed was moderate, right? And then it became evident that it was dominated by jihadis, by ISIS, by Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the official al-Qaeda franchise, if you like, and other jihadi groups. And they still say that, we support the moderate opposition, but actually the opposition to Assad in Syria is completely dominated by these jihadis. If you supply anything to the moderate groups, any weapon, I've been told by Iraqi security when they question prisoners, ISIS says, oh, that's great. So, any weapon supplied to these fellows ends up in our armory, a couple of weeks later. So they pretended that there was a Syrian moderate opposition to support, and now they're trying to pretend that there's a Sunni moderate opposition that is different from ISIS in Iraq. I mean, there may be, but it's not doing anything. So, if you're against these guys, then they should persuade people like the Free Syrian Army to ally themselves with Assad and fight ISIS. Here, if they want to get rid of ISIS, they need to talk to the Iranians, who are the only people who can really do something here, assuming there's not going to be another American invasion, to fight ISIS. I mean, these guys are sort of, what one commentator called holy fascists, He's like sort of dealing with the Nazis. But they're still held up, I mean, the UN, Washington and London and Paris and all the others, by this pretense that there's a sort of third way, that there's a moderate Syrian opposition, a moderate Sunni community in Iraq, which is why their policies aren't getting anywhere.
Yeah. Well, it seems like when America sides with Assad, then it's like George W. Bush paying him to torture these guys to death, which that just leads to its own blowback. What if we just said everybody else except us work it out and just butt out completely?
Well, you could do that, but it's kind of not going to happen, But I mean, in a way, it sort of has happened, I suppose, another way of looking. You have John Kerry sort of fluttering around the Middle East, looking sincere and, sort of jaw set, but it's pretty obvious they don't have a policy. They don't know what they're going to do. They get very edgy about the thought of maybe sort of somehow collaborating openly with the Iranians, which what they've been doing for years anyway. Why is Maliki prime minister of Iraq because America and Iran agreed that he would be. Mm-hmm. There's no way the Americans would really push somebody who the Iranians couldn't get along with. But they don't dare do this publicly. So I think, you know, they sort of footle along. And, you know, what the big contrast here is between how quick ISIS is to make military gains on the ground and against this background of sort of grindingly slow diplomacy and a pretense that a new government in Baghdad is going to make much difference.
Yeah. Well, what did you think when you saw that that Assad, and of course he only just killed a bunch of civilians, but Assad attacked supposedly ISIS targets inside Iraq, and Maliki said thanks.
Yeah, there's something peculiar about this. Maliki sort of said thanks, and then they sort of suddenly said they hadn't said thanks. I don't know, then maybe they thought they'd upset the Americans, or maybe it wasn't true. I mean, I think it's going to be kind of difficult, I would have thought, for the U.S. to say everything must be done to stop ISIS, but the Syrians are not allowed to attack them in Iraq, although ISIS doesn't recognize that border anyway. You know, are they saying that ISIS should have a safe haven in Iraq and Assad shouldn't attack them? Of course, their other thing is to say, well, somehow ISIS was created by Assad and he never fights them. But then when he is fighting them, are they really going to object? You know, so I think they've got themselves into a tremendous muddle.
Yeah, it's completely ridiculous. Well, except for it's a tragedy, too. Yeah, I mean, it is worth pointing out that all things being equal, with the rise of ISIS and Nusra and the rest of this, if there's such a thing as a moderate in power over there, it's Assad. And, I mean, he's a dictator, but he's an elected dictator, which is a pretty good way to be a dictator, I guess. You know, he's got his brutal secret police and all that, but he's a secularist. And so, by that standard, that makes him the most moderate leader in the region, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like a lot of Syrians say, Assad pretty bad, but the alternative even worse. You know, it may turn out, you know, the Sunni in Iraq, the same thing, you know, that Maliki pretty bad, but the alternative may turn out to be worse. Mm-hmm. You know, I wouldn't like to be a moderate. I wouldn't like to be a woman in Mosul at the moment. You can't get out of the house, you know. You know, they might have, by allowing, they had every reason to revolt by allowing this revolt to be led by ISIS. I think this is going to have a disastrous effect for them in the future.
Yeah, well, and of course, when you say that America and Iran agreed on Maliki, it was the Iranians, if I remember right, they preferred someone from the Supreme Islamic Council. And so Maliki, or really Jafari before him, and then Maliki, they were kind of the compromise since they were from the Dawa party, which they were Iraqi expats in Iran, just like the Skiri, except they didn't have their own army. So they didn't have, I don't know exactly what the discrepancy was. Why? I was going to say... they would be less independent. But anyway, for whatever reason, they didn't want... I'm trying to remember the name of the guy from Hakim's group, Al-Mahdi, I think, that they wanted to... the Iranians wanted to put in power. And so they compromised and put in this guy. So if they got rid of Maliki, if it's not ISIS taking power, it could be guys who are much more Iranian than Maliki and much worse from the Sunnis' point of view than Maliki has been for them.
Yeah, I mean... You know, the thing is, first of all, the sort of political class here is basically criminalized. You know, one of the reasons for the Sunni revolt, one of the reasons for Shia discontent is, you know, in a country with really quite a lot of $100 billion a year in oil revenues, you know, there is mass poverty. People are malnourished. People, there are no facilities. It's difficult to get electricity or clean water. All these things are wrong. So you're dealing with this kind of criminalized political class. And that's what makes it so difficult. And me sort of tweaking it and putting in a new leader here and there, is it going to make much difference? You know, I doubt it. There are some people who wouldn't be too bad, but, you know, the real difficulty in dealing with a system which has been kind of run by racketeers for racketeers for the last, certainly since about 2007 or 2008, and back earlier.
Mm-hmm. All right. And now, real quick at the end here, to get back to what you were saying about Kurdistan at the beginning, is this really the end of the Shia Kurdish alliance formed in 2003 with the American invasion? And do the Peshmerga have the ability to really guarantee independence and protection from ISIS, from the Shia armies, from whoever? And is this that time now?
I think they probably do, yeah, militarily. You know, they've taken the oil fields of Kirkuk, so potentially they don't actually have the money in their pocket now. They're doing pretty well. They're getting on with the Turks. It used to be the Turks said, you know, if the Kurds took Kirkuk, they'd invade. Now the Kirks, you know, the Turks don't really care, but they plan to ally. They have allied themselves with the Iraqi Kurds. So, you know, this is the Kurds' moment. And, of course, whatever's wrong in Kurdistan, it looks an awful lot better than what's happening in the rest of the country.
Yeah, I was reading a thing by a writer, anyway, I don't know how you characterize him, but he was talking about how all of the different Yazidis and Turkmen and Chaldean Christians and who all kinds of refugees are hiding in the foothills up there in Kurdistan, and that's, you know, the ISIS guys are just below and would love to cut them all into little pieces if they could, and I guess it's all up to the Peshmerga to draw that line and keep them out.
Yeah, I mean, it's all actually a disaster here, you know, that it's you have ethnic cleansing, you have sectarian cleansing, you know, people are running, people are being massacred. Usually they run before they've been massacred. But, you know, how many Shia are going to be left in this sort of Sunni enclave? Not too many. Of course, what would happen if they did attack Baghdad and the Sunni enclaves are about 20% of the city rose up? Then you would see some real massacres, and you could see this Sunni pushed out of Baghdad, and you could see, you know, millions of people on the roads again. So, you know, things are pretty bad, but they could get an awful lot worse.
Right, yeah, there's still a lot of Shia in the predominantly Sunni areas as well. And there have been, you know, they never got as much coverage when they were cleansed from the Sunni areas, but there was a lot of that during the war, too, so that could all happen again as well.
Yeah, there are sort of mixed areas. You know, it's people used to have long time been talking about the partition of Iraq, but, you know, a friend of mine who used to say, you know, Iraqi used to say, well, yeah, it'd still be a partition of Iraq, like a bit like a partition of India in 1947, you know, when Hindus and Muslims were butchering each other, you know, and you end up with a million dead. So you could do it.
Right.
But
partition, but a lot of people on the wrong sides of the lines.
Yeah, and a lot of dead people on the wrong side of the line, you know.
Yeah.
So there's a potential for that here as well.
All right. Well, it sounds like, as impossible as it seems, this is the calm before the coming storm here. So Patrick Coburn, bravely reporting from Baghdad, as always in a crisis like this. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you, Scott.
Patrick Coburn, he's at independent.co.uk, and the book is Muqtada.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today, corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson, available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com, or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.